Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Frontside Podcast, episode 97. My name is Charles Lowell. I'm a developer here at the Frontside and your podcast host in training. And with me today, we have two very special guests. They are have been working on technologies that have run very parallel to my entire career as a software developer, and we're going to talk about that. So with us today are Eric Gamma and Dirk Boehmer, who are developers on the team developing VS Code, which, if you're in the front-end space, is taking that area of development by storm. It's just amazing, some of the things that they can do. Lots of people are using it every day. Lots of people are trying it. And so we're going to talk about the technologies that underlie that and kind of the story of how it came to be. So welcome, Eric, and welcome, Dirk.
Hello from Zurich.
All right. Zurich to Albuquerque. Here we go. As a first start, I would have to say, like, you know, my first contact with this story, I at least have to mention it because, and this is for Eric, you wrote a book that was very, very instrumental in kind of my formation as a young developer. I think I was about 22 years old when I read Design Patterns. And I don't know, I still carry a lot of those things with me to this day, even though a lot of things have changed about the way that we do development. I still carry a lot of those lessons, I think, especially things like the state pattern and the strategy pattern and stuff like that. I want to move on to other things, but I was hoping that we could talk just a little bit about what are the things that you find still kind of relevant today?
Well, no, as you said, some of the things are kind of timeless, and we're lucky to have found these things, and I still love all the patterns. But I must say, things have changed, right? So at that time, we thought objects are very cool. And as we have evolved, all of a sudden, we think, oh, functions are actually very cool too, right? Closures and so on. So I think we got more broader. And of course, if you use function programming, you have many more patterns available as you program. So I say some of the object thinking still applies, but that's not the only thing that counts anymore, right? Today, it's kind of functions, stateless, immutability, and all the things you do in functional programming, which is great and which we practice daily in our team, right?
Yeah. I would love to see kind of an update to, you know, how do these concepts transfer into functional programming. But anyway, just wanted to say thank you for that. And it was about the same time that, you know, a few years after, I don't know the exact same timing, I want to wind back because we're going to talk about VS Code. But before VS Code, there was a project that both of you all worked on called Eclipse, which, you know, I also used because at the very beginning of my career, I did a lot of Java development. And it really opened my eyes into a level of what tooling could do for you that I didn't see before. And I was wondering, how did you arrive to there? Because, I mean, before that, you know, I was using, you know, Emacs and Vim and, you know, Joe's editor and things that were kind of editing the text files. And how did you kind of arrive at that problem? Because I feel like it's very similar to the one that VS Code solves. But it was, you know, this is what, 15 years ago?
I think it's older, right? It's
really?
17, 18. Yeah. It was after the millennium, right?
Yeah.
So to be honest, right? So Eclipse wasn't the first development tool we worked on, right? And we worked on the company Object Technology National, right? They worked on Smalltalk tools. And of course, Smalltalk had a great IDE experience, right? So when then started Java became popular, one idea was how can you preserve the great Smalltalk coding experience? And find all references, method level history, versioning, and so on. So that was kind of the input that got Eclipse kicked off. And one idea we had at that time, Eclipse is our opportunity to make everything right. And as we have seen now, when we did VS Code, right, we could even improve what we have done at that time. So an example, right, in Eclipse, we thought, plugins are very cool, and now we have kind of like a microkernel, and you load all the plugins in the same process. They have a rich API and so on, which is great, right? But we found over time, if you have lots of plugins and to do bad things and they're on the same process, it's not the best thing.
Ah, right. And so
we have a different architecture, right? We believe now in isolation, separation. So we now run extension in a separate process that communicates through RPC with the IDE so that we are in full control. And we can always say you can save the tool, the save document, no matter how bad a plugin behaves and decides to do an endless loop, right? Because in a separate process, the hope is still one CPU is open, available for you that it can save from the other process. So that's some example, right? Eclipse has done many things right, but the multi-process architecture, I think, is a major switch. And the other major switch is at the Eclipse time, we think Java is cool. Everything has to be in Java, right?
Right.
And no longer think like that. And that brings us this other topic of then the language service that we can also talk at some point.
Right, because that's the thing is VS Code. I mean, now I've primarily been exposed to it through JavaScript and TypeScript development, but it really, you know, it's designed to support all kinds of different languages. So, I mean, the C++ support is really good, the C support is really good, and I assume the Java support is really good. Is it safe to say, because I only ever used Eclipse in the context of Java, did Eclipse gain kind of a wider acceptance further beyond Java and C++?
Yeah, I think it's fair to say Eclipse has a rich ecosystem. Yeah, support web tools, and it will be interesting to see, right, that you can close the loop, because for Visual Studio Code, when you do Java development, you actually run Eclipse behind the scenes. That's how we kind of smiled at each other, Dirk and I, when you say, now we close the loop, right? Mm-hmm. We started with all JavaScript, and then we integrate Eclipse using this language server protocol, and that's how we close the loop. Yeah.
So maybe one thing I would like to add is that when you look at Eclipse and the tool and framework landscape that existed in the Java time, at that point in time when we started with Eclipse, it was very well-defined, right? There was Java, it was a well-defined set of libraries you were using and frameworks you were using. And if you look at the programming and tool landscape you have today, and months you see a new framework for JavaScript popping up, or there's something else or another cool XYZ thing. So the tooling you build today has to be a lot more open to these new inventions, mm-hmm. especially since they occur in a higher frequency than they did in the past. And that had influence on how we architectured Visual Studio Code to give people a lower barrier of integrating their stuff into Visual Studio Code than you typically have in Eclipse. In Eclipse, mm-hmm. you need to program in Java. With the LSP, you can program in any programming language. In Eclipse, if you really want to try to do something nice with code complete and stuff like that, you had to hook up a lot of stuff. So we raised that to another abstraction layer where we more talk about what people provide on data, and we do a lot more for them in the user interface than mm-hmm. compared, for example, to Eclipse, which lowers the barrier for people to integrate languages in Visual Studio Code than the barrier you had to integrate something in Eclipse. And so, the driver for that one was that there are a lot more tools and programming languages out there that have importance than 10 years ago.
I'll give you an example, right? So when we did C support in Eclipse, and was also the team that seeded it, of course it took over and has now a great community behind it in Eclipse, but you wrote the C tooling in Java, right? So, and of course that means you build the parser in Java, and then of course there are great C parsers around, right? C frameworks, but also it means you cannot dog food what you write, right? You write Java, but you don't program in C++. So I think which is what makes VS Code so appealing is we are a very aggressive dog fooder, right? We want to use ourselves, and of course you program TypeScript. That's why TypeScript is very good. The C++ guy, they program C++, and they write in C++. So then that's how they make it very good, right? That you have this feedback loop.
And so what's an example? Well, you talked about this low barrier of entry. So if I were wanting to say, you know, I do mostly like programming in JavaScript, like let's say I wanted to add, I know all of this already exists, this infrastructure already exists, but let's say I wanted to add kind of smart editing to JavaScript source files. What would that process look like for me as a JavaScript developer?
To be fair, right? When Eric comes to language services, it's never easy. While Dirk says lower the bar, yeah. right? A language always means you have to do parsing, you have to do type analysis, type bindings, you have to make it fast, scale high up, and so on. So this is never easy. But I think if you think about the different steps you can do, right? The first thing, let's not take JavaScript. Let's take a new language, right?
Okay.
Your new cool language, right?
Let's do, or maybe we take like a Lisp or something where the part writing the parser is very easy.
Even that, right? You have to resolve symbols and so on. Even
okay.
the part.
Okay.
But yeah, let's take a fancy language like a Lisp or whatever. So the first level, I think, is you want to get some nicely coloring, right? That's the first level.
Yes.
So we get some coloring. And what we do there, actually in VS Code, that is we tap into the community from TextMate. So we use TextMate grammars to support colored languages, which gives us access to a long tail of languages. So the chances are high, if your language is not too exotic, you will find a grammar that describes how to color, what the tokens are in your language, and then you can get your language color.
Mm-hmm.
That's step one. The next step is, of course, you want to get smarts like IntelliSense and so on. Ideally, of course, you can say, oh, well, maybe there is something already around that has abstracted the parser and you can use this library.
Right, because there actually are a bunch of JavaScript parsers written in JavaScript. I know I keep coming back to JavaScript, but let's assume this language that we've got, right? I may not have to write a parser, but I've got one.
You got one, exactly. You got one, right? And then typically it's not in the same language as the tool. So that's why I don't want to go too much into JavaScript because, for instance, VS Code is written in TypeScript, right? Which transpiles to JavaScript, which moves a little bit, makes it not as convincing as it could be. So let's say it's a different language, right? Your fancy language is written, has a parser written in your fancy language, which is different than the language of VS Code, which is JavaScript.
Right.
So then the next level is to say, okay, well, you have your code, you encapsulate it in a server that you can talk to through some protocol.
Mm-hmm.
And now the challenge is, what protocol do you talk to, right? Typically,
right.
in the language, the library you get, it will give you some ASTs, symbols, type bindings. And what Dirk mentioned with lowering the bar is that, assuming you have these ASTs, the way you talk then with our tool is through a protocol that is not at the level of the ASTs, but at a higher level.
A higher level than the ASTs?
No, yeah. A higher or simpler level. Let's give you an example, right? Yep. So, you want to find the definition of a symbol in your fancy language.
Right.
The way the protocol works is you only tell it, in this document with a URI, at this position, I want to find the definition of the symbol that is at this position.
Mm-hmm.
Right? The request goes over the wire to the other process, document URI, and the textual position. And what comes back, of course, now in the server, you used AST, you find the symbol, you find the binding of the symbol, which means gives it a definition for it. Of course, you use your AST to analyze it.
Mm-hmm.
But then what gets back to the sender of the wire is yet another document, a reference, and a position.
I see. So you're really like, you're pinpointing a point, you know, in like the just the raw bytes of the document, and you're saying, look, what is here? And you just want to delegate that completely and totally to this other process. So the IDE itself doesn't know anything about the document.
It knows about the document, right?
I mean, it knows about the textual positions of the document and the stream of characters, but not the meaning.
True, right? The smarts are in the server, and you talk to these smarts at the level of documents and positions. And
so,
since the protocol is at this level, it makes it easy to integrate into one editor, which is VS Code, but also into other editors, right? So that's why we came up with the idea to have a common language server protocol, which allows to provide a language not only for one editor, but also for many editors.
Mm-hmm.
That was a challenge we had in VS Code, right? So remember when we started, we were kind of late to the game. We said VS Code should be in between an IDE and an editor. But what we like from an IDE is, of course, code understanding, IntelliSense, go to definition, find all references, right? But how do you get that for a long tail of languages? You cannot do it all ourselves. So need to get a community to tap into. Similar like TextMate grammars are kind of a lingua franca for coloring, right? So we are looking for the lingua franca for language smarts. And that's what the language server protocol is, which means you can integrate in different IDEs. And once you've written a language server, you can reuse it.
I guess I've got two questions. What are the kind of things that I can do with a server that implements the language server protocol? And then I guess we've talked about being able to find a reference. And is there a way you can incrementally implement certain parts of the protocol as you go along?
Yeah. Basically, you can just the protocol on the server and the client side talks about capabilities. Mm-hmm. The server can, for example, say, I'm only supporting code complete and go to definition and find all references. And for example, something like implementation hierarchy or document symbols or outline view is not supported. And then the client adapts dynamically to the capabilities of the server.
Okay.
That's one thing. And the set of capabilities is not fixed. So we mm-hmm. add them. We just added the four or five new capabilities to the protocol last week. So, of course, we listen to requests that come from other IDEs, what they would like to see in the protocol, stuff we see in Visual Studio Code we would like to extend. And that's the way how we move the protocol forward. It's
okay.
capability-based and not, so to speak, version-based.
So you can find
versioning at the end of the day.
Right. You can incrementally, you can say, if I'm starting to write a server, I can say, well, I'm going to only start with just find definition at point. And that's the only thing that my server can do.
Well, careful. There is some basics, right? Keep in mind, you have two processes, right? And once the user opens an editor, yes. The truth is in the buffer in memory of one process. The basic thing you have to in a language, so you have to support the synchronization of once you open a file in the editor, then the truth in the buffer, and then you have to sync it over.
Yeah.
Right.
Once it's closed, the truth on the file system, and you also have to tell this to the server, right? Because the server has to know where the truth is.
Yeah, that's okay. Correct. These two open close handshake methods and change methods, this is the minimum you have to implement. But for example, for Node itself, we provide libraries that help you with this. And the protocol is not very complicated, right? It's a buffer, and then it's a change event. Either it's an insert, a delete, or an edit.
So let me try and get this straight in my head. I think I understand the problem is that the VS Code or your code editor, it's actually making changes to the buffer, and it needs to communicate those changes to the server, or does the server actually make the changes itself?
The editor does make the changes, so the protocol is spec'd in a way that as soon as an editor opens a document, the ownership travels from the server for the content to the tool,
mm-hmm.
and the server is basically not allowed to read the state of that content from disk anymore or get it. Therefore, the client guarantees that everything the user does in that document is notified to the server so that the server can move the document forward.
Okay.
And the server receives a closed event that basically with the closed transfers the ownership of the document back to the language server, and it is allowed to reread that content from disk if it wants.
Okay.
Here is the protocol is really data driven. Dirk mentioned that earlier, right? So basically what flows between the server and the tool is data, right? So what we mean by data, you ask for IntelliSense or completions at a line. What follows is just the data, a list of completions that flows then from the server to the client, right? And then the client decides what to do with this data and decides to modify the document by inserting the completion proposed that the user selected.
Yeah. Right. But then, and then it sends if it decides to make any updates, it needs to send those to the server.
Exactly.
So if I actually insert the method that I want to call there, you know, I'm going to be inserting 9 characters and I need to tell the server, hey, I just inserted 9 characters to this document, something like that.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. And so now because I remember now one of the coolest things about, you know, the class of tools of Eclipse that I haven't really seen in kind of the more lightweight editors. Like I went from Java, like so many of my generation went from Java to Ruby. And then to JavaScript, you know, once I moved out of the Java world, like one of the things that I had come to expect from my tools was that they would help me make modifications to my code base at a very high level. So I would be able, if I had some class that was imported into, say, 5 modules in my code base, I could say, I want to change the name of this class, and then it would find the references and then make the updates to those things. So how do you manage that? So like if I have a class called person that I want to change to user, if I change it to user, then it's going to break in those 5 different places unless I rename it to user. That's something that was very doable in the Java world. How do you keep the code editor, the tool, I guess is what you were calling it, in sync if like the server is going to make that change, or does it just come back with data and says, here's the references if you want to make the change?
So 2 things you mentioned, right? Java and JavaScript, of course. Java is a typed language, mm-hmm. which means you have better understanding of the code and what the reference is, right? In JavaScript, which is typeless, you cannot know it as much. So that's actually why we developed also, or using TypeScript, right? VS Code is actually implementing TypeScript, which allows you to do these kind of things like refactorings. But if you look at the language server protocol, it has support for rename. And the way how a rename is done is, again, it just documents some positions, right? You say at this position, I want to rename the symbol with this other name. And then you tell this to the server, and the server will handle rename by giving you back a list of positions that needs to be updated.
Ah, okay. So now I'm starting to understand what you're talking about when you say data-driven. It's literally just telling the tool. The tool says, proposes, I want to do this rename. And then the server provides all of the information that is required to actually do the rename. But it doesn't actually do the rename itself. It just provides the data.
A couple of reasons for it. The data is, at the end of the day, it's again edits, and it's more or less the same edits the client sent to the server when the user types in the document. This is the protocol. On top of it, something that you can create a file or rename a file. This comes as a result back to the client. And then there, since it is a client-server architecture, the whole process is async. So we have to give the client the chance to revalidate if that edit structure that comes is still valid. If it is still valid, the client basically applies it. And by applying these edits to these documents, they will automatically flow back to the server until this client either closes these documents again or saves them. So the reason being is that some of the tools may even show you a preview. You can only select some of them and apply them. So there's always an interaction in these refactorings. And to make that possible, as Eric mentioned, the whole protocol is data-driven. We don't go to the server and say, okay, do that rename, and he writes that back to disk. It computes a set of transformations to bring the current state of the workspace into that new state after the refactoring.
I see.
To be fully transparent, right? So refactorings, Dirk did the Java refactorings for Eclipse, so we can go deep on that. What we don't support right now in the protocol, we support edits in the buffer, but when you want to rename a class in Java, you also want to rename the file, and that's something we currently work on to support that. In the specification of the language server protocol, right? Mm-hmm. So don't have that yet. But we support code actions, quick fixes that you like from Eclipse probably, and you can use them to do refactorings like extract method, extract constant, or extract local variable, things like that. You can do at the level of the language server protocol.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's
interestingly, right? Now let me go back to the Java thing, right? The Java language server actually has the support for refactorings, and there is now a language server protocol implementation of this Java from provided by Eclipse. So all the support you had in Eclipse for mm-hmm. Java, or most of the support, is now also available in VS Code.
Right.
Now you have to re-implement it because you can reuse. And that's the big thought we have, right? You want to reuse language smart as much as possible because they are so hard to implement.
Right. And so you can do that because you're providing this abstraction between the tool and the actual smarts, which is really, really cool. How do you make it fast? That's, because we're describing this tool, this client, and this server, and they're syncing, they're keeping this distributed state in sync. And, how do you keep that from becoming too chatty? Or how do you, like, is it something that you have to consider? Or is it just, you know, maybe I'm overthinking it because I haven't dealt with it?
So at the end of the day, it is chatty, right? But it is made chatty. So it's made performant in a way that it's very incremental and partly event-based. So, for example, if you type in a document in the editor, you can either decide to always sync the full content of the document, which we do not recommend, but for some basic exploration, that is something people do. And we have a full delta encoded mechanism. So we sync the buffer once, and then after that, you only get the edits the user do. These are chatty, of course, since the user types them, we debounce them, collapse them on the client side, and only send them if we know that the server really needs to know them, because we have another request we are asking the server or after a certain of timeout. So there are smarts behind it. But the protocol is kept performant by making it an incremental protocol at the end of the day and not sending too much data back and forth.
Right. We don't serialize ASTs, right? Yep. We serialize positions, a list of items for completions. And actually, the transport is just JSON RPC.
Okay.
And to be actually someone, there is different usage in the language server protocol. And there is one host, EclipseJ, which brings again back to Eclipse. They actually run language servers remote.
Right? Interesting.
If you use it, right, you can run in the browser, get IntelliSense, and of course, I guess it depends on how far away you are from the server. But it seems to work according to the feedback.
Really?
The feedback we heard from them is pleasant. So they use many of the language servers. Yeah.
So is this a product that they have where the language server is running in the cloud, and you send your entire code base essentially goes over to the language server, and you can kind of export the smarts to the cloud.
It's one step at a time, right? So EclipseJ is kind of, they have what they call cloud workspaces, which means the workspace is in the cloud. Mm-hmm. And then in order to get code smarts of the workspace in the cloud, they can run language servers in the cloud. It's a one-to-one mapping, right? One user has one workspace, has one language server.
Mm-hmm. That sounds amazing. And if they can make it performant.
We have done cloud IDs, right? If you look at the history from Visual Studio Code, we also had our stuff running in the cloud at some point. That's how we start. Before we pivoted to VS Code, we built our exploration was. That's why the project is 6 years old, right? The first 2 years, we kind of explored how far you can get coding done in the browser.
Right.
And we had some things there, right? So, yeah.
But even so, but it's so... You know, I've played around with a lot of cloud IDEs, and I've found them to be neat because every few years it comes along. But yeah, it does seem that there are certain challenges that it's nice to have a client running and just be able to have the files locally. And is that a performance thing? Or I mean, if VS Code is written in TypeScript, theoretically it could run in the browser, right?
Of course, the Monaco editor still runs in the browser, right? And it's used by many tools that run in the browser. Like on Azure, if you want to edit your source code in the browser there, it's using the same editor that's running VS Code.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how we started. Now, cloud IDs, yeah, we were at this point, right? We had our kind of cloud IDE. We could edit websites in the browser, source control them, have a command line, deploy them. But what we found is it's great for some scenarios, like code reviews or doing small tweaks to files. But when it comes to real development, you use so many other tools, right? And you want to just have them, and we call this the long tool chain problem, right? So as a developer, you just reuse other tools as well, right? And that's why you can't have them all in the cloud. And
right.
For that reason, we said at some point, it was a great lesson we had that you can program in the browser. But now if you want to go to cover really 7x24 coding, you want to have a desktop experience. So what we then did, we moved over the code we had running the browser using a shell, the Electron shell, and can run it on the desktop.
But there's theoretically, you could be running your language server, for example, in the cloud, but everything else on the desktop.
Yeah. Some people do that, right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Wow. It's crazy. It's heady stuff. we've talked about, you know, the barrier to implement the code smarts is much lower than it has been in the past. What kind of proliferation of code smart tools are there now for the, that implement the language server protocol? Like, how many different languages would you say like have like kind of airtight?
So now it's time where we don't count anymore. You tell us a language and I can look it up whether it's supported. Tell me a language and I can tell you whether. No, we have a website, right?
So, okay.
And when I look at it, we have about 40 languages.
Mm-hmm. Wow. That's probably about, so pretty much every mainstream language.
Yeah, I cannot find it isn't there.
It almost kind of begs the question, is this going to be kind of the new bar for a language? Because I remember when I was starting out, really, you just needed to have some interpreter or some compiler to have, quote unquote, a language. And nowadays, you know, it's not just the language. You need to have a command line tool for managing your dependencies. And you need to have a package system with a public repository where people can publish reusable units of code. And, you know, what's become kind of expected out of a language to succeed has upped is having a language server implementation going to be part of the bar, the new bar for, hey, I'm thinking about creating a language. I haven't really arrived until I have a package manager, I have a command line for resolving dependencies, I have documentation, and I have a language server.
I personally think that is our dream at the end of the day to get there. We know about languages that do so. So a lot of these language servers come, for example, from the people that develop the language. For example, the Rust guys, they do the compiler and they actively work on their language server as well. So at the end of the day, the advantage of that approach, since the Rust language server is written in Rust and runs in Rust, they can reuse so much code that they already have written in Rust. That's easy for them to package that up in the server. And basically, the people that maintain the compiler, at least the same team maintains the language server at the end of the day.
And that's why we call them, it's a win-win for the language provider. Because if you implement the language server using the language server protocol, then it can be integrated easily by the tool provider. And it's a win for the tool provider, since there is a common protocol across all these languages you have to support. You can write an implementation once and again benefit and support many different languages, right? Which makes kind of the matrix problem one language support for each tool into more, a vector, right? It reduces the matrix into a vector. You only write language servers that get integrated into different tools.
It is especially, I think, appealing for new languages that come out, right? Because it lowers the bar for them to get into existing tools. Because if they write a language server for speaking the language server protocol, integrating that at the end of the day in Visual Studio Code is basically packaging up an extension for Visual Studio Code and writing 20 lines of code.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And same is true for other IDEs that exist where people implemented the language protocol client side for the tool, for example, for Vim or for Atom.
Mm-hmm.
So new languages, I think definitely we see that trend go onto the language server protocol because that gives them an entry point into a large tool community.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's I'm really excited about it. I'm actually an Emacs user, and that's actually how I found out about LSP. In my Emacs newsfeed, I saw that someone was starting on LSP support, and got digging into it. And I think that one of the problems that has plagued not only Emacs but all these editors is what you're describing, where, for example, the JavaScript support was really great. In Emacs. There's refactorings, there's, IntelliSense, code completion, all that stuff. But that's because someone wrote an entire JavaScript parser and like code smart system in ELISP, which is just an absurd hurdle to jump over to expect. And so what you expect out of your editing experience, like when I went to try, you know, if I were to go to try Python, well, it's not nearly as good as what I'm expecting. And so, you know, I think it's exciting to hear what you're describing, where with, you know, having some shared set of abstractions, you can, you know, offload all of that code smart onto the community that's building these new tools so that they're really easy to integrate into your environment. I think it's really exciting. Although it does make me ask, and I think we've got time for one more question, is, you know, we've been talking about all these different languages, Java, C++, JavaScript, TypeScript, Ruby, Python, et cetera, all these, you know, the 40 languages that you talked about that have this implementation. What are the challenges that you've encountered trying to build abstractions that work for 40 different languages, right? All with their different syntax, all with their different conventions. I mean, it sounds like, when aside from the fact that it's, you've actually done it, I would like say it's impossible. So I'm curious, what were the unique challenges to solve there?
I think we already touched that at the beginning. The appealing stuff of the LSP is that it is not talking about the programming language itself. It's talking about things I can do with source code. For example, requesting code complete, go to definition, find all the references. And the data that flows between the client and the server is not in terms of the programming language itself. It's about editor abstractions. We talk about documents and positions. We talk about edits that are applied to documents. We talk about snippets and stuff like that. And these abstractions, since they are programming language neutral, are a lot easier to implement for different editors. An approach where the protocol would speak AST nodes and symbols and functions and classes and methods, that at the end of the day would not work, right? Because if I ask go to definition, the result is not a function or a variable definition, it's simply a position in the document with a hint which range to select.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah.
Only a few places you have to really abstract across languages, like, for instance, completions, right? When you do a completions, they don't know, is it a variable, is it a function or method? That's where we have to abstract, right? But that's one of the few places. But again, this is an enumeration.
And that's only to present an icon.
Yes.
Yeah. It's only to give you a nice icon in front, because when you insert it, what comes back for a completion item is basically a textual edit or a bunch of textual edits that when you select that completion item, we take these edits and apply them to the document buffer. And whether you edit a functional programming language or some other stuff, Prolog or whatsoever, does not matter at the end of the day.
Yeah, that simplicity and treating it at that simple of a level is what unlocks all those superpowers.
Kind of lowering the bar, but of course, if you look at some advanced refactorings or whatever, they cannot easily be funneled. Not all of them can funnel to this low-level abstraction. So there, of course, the criticism of the LSP protocol is that if you have already a very rich language service, right, you might not get it all through the LSP, right? Mm-hmm. To be honest, right? That's a limitation, that criticism we see at LSP, but it's a trade-off, like so many things in software. Mm-hmm.
But what we learned there, looking at different types of refactorings, it's more the set of input parameters that vary very much between languages. The result of a refactoring can, for every programming language that is at least document-based, be described in that lingo the LSP speaks, because at the end of the day, it's textual edits to a document, right?
Mm-hmm. So many people... LSP, but there are people that don't like it, right? And people that have rich language services, like, you know, IntelliJ, cool tool, right? And they say, well, if you would LSP, we would only get 20% of our cool features, which is a little bit downgraded, not really true. But you see, it's a trade-off, right?
Right.
If you want to read the language available broadly, I highly recommend it packaged as a language server. Your chances that it gets used, support by different tools, is much higher than anything else.
Right. So it's kind of like the Unix thing, the universal text interface, and how it seems counterintuitive, but it actually just means that you can literally compose anything, because so few assumptions are made.
I would just recommend, rather than talks, go to the website that we have about the language server protocol. I'm pretty sure it will be in the introduction or whatever. It's Microsoft GitHub.io language server protocol. And then you see the implementations, all the implementation languages, who integrates language servers, and also what kind of libraries are available if you want to implement the language.
And the full specification.
And the specification is there as well. Yeah.
Yep, if you want to go ahead and do it yourself. Well, thank you so much, Eric. Thank you so much, Dirk, for coming on the show to talk about the language server protocol. It's very exciting to me, and I think it is exciting for development in general, because I just think, you know, by having, even if it's, you know, 20, 30, 50% code smarts for every single language, just the billions and billions of hours that you are going to save developers over the next, over the coming years. It's a great feeling to think about. So thank you for all your work, and thank you for coming on the show.
You're welcome.
Yeah, it was fun talking to you.
Yeah, our pleasure.
Yeah. If people want to continue the conversation, is there a good way that they can get in touch with you?
Usually GitHub issues. So for where the language protocol is, it's an open project on GitHub. Simply file issues. We accept pull requests. I think that's the way we communicate.
Awesome. Again, if you want to get in touch with us, you can get in touch with us at contact@frontside.io, or you can reach out to us on Twitter. We're at the Frontside. So thank you, everybody, for listening, and we will see you next time.